most primary care family physicians you talk to will say that about half of their visits in any given week are emotional, situational, relational problems.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and Off the Couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz. I'm an analyst on the faculty at Psychoanalytic Association of New York and the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia. Our guest today on the podcast is Dr. Randall Paulson. Dr. Paulson is a psychiatrist and a training and supervising psychoanalyst and past president of the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute. He is an associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and currently supervises and consults at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Dr. Paulson's career has been focused on applied psychoanalysis. He directed inpatient and day hospitals at Tufts New England Medical Center. He developed primary care psychiatry as a component of healthcare associates and facilitated a long-term balance group for physicians, which is the subject of today's interview. He was the mind-body consultant at the Osher Clinic at Brigham and Women's Hospital, where he also led mindfulness-based stress reduction courses. He views psychoanalysis as a subjective science in healthcare, human development, and relationships, both individual, group, and institutional. Currently, he has a private practice of psychoanalysis in Lexington. Here's my interview with Dr. Paulson. Randy, welcome to today's podcast.
Thank you.
Ballant has a special place in my heart back from my medical student days. It was when I began rotating on the medical inpatient units, and I was a young, impressionable medical student, but it seemed to me that these often fragile and frightened patients were treated in a more mechanical fashion by the medical staff than I thought advisable, albeit a young student that I was. And I was talking to a friend, and he recommended to me that I read about the balance, about whom I knew nothing. And I picked up a book from back then that I have in my hand now. It's a real treat to reread it, The Psychotherapeutic Techniques in Medicine by the Balance from 1961. And even at that point, I was struck by what a wonderful, rich source of clinical wisdom and empathy and real practical utility it was. So in anticipation of our talk today, I found the book and started rereading it. And here, 45 years later, I am left with the same impression that it really is a rich source of clinical wisdom, empathy, and practical advice. And I can only think today, when there's so much talk about physician burnout, that there's so much call for groups like Ballant. You're just a terrific person to help us with this. Can you share with us something about the history of Ballant groups and your own involvement with them in the Boston community?
Sure. Well, I never met Michael Ballant, but I do have had good friendships and conversations with two people who knew him well, actually three, Paul and Anna Ornstein, who moved to Boston to be with their children and grandchildren, maybe 20 years ago, but they were in Cincinnati for years where Michael Ballant was invited once or twice a year to be a visiting professor and consultant. And so they got to know him very well. So I hear what he was like from them. And from my former boss, Don Lipset, wrote one of the really nice recent papers about Ballant and the Boston Ballant Group, which is the group that Don started. And then I sort of handed it off to me, and I ran it for probably 12 years. It's a very stable group. It's in some ways an outlier in terms of Ballant groups, and it's full of very senior trainers and faculty people. But there came a time in about maybe 14 years ago when I got busy with the Boston Psychoanalytic, and I handed it off to a colleague and mentee, a friend of mine, Aaron Metzger, who runs it to this day. But back to Ballant, he was born in Hungary. His father was a primary care physician. So he worked in the clinic with his father as a teenager. Then he, at some point, went off to Berlin as a young man and pursued, I think that's where he did medical education. I'm not sure. I think that was probably around, he was in Berlin. No, I think he was in Berlin by 1910. I know he was, I think, a medical student or a resident in 1918 when Freud gave a talk at the Hungarian Institute, Budapest, on Freud's position that there would come a day when people's right to mental health and access to mental treatment was on a par with their right to access to medical treatment. And and Ballant was analyzed by Ferenczi and then joined him in the creation of the Hungarian Institute. I think it was Ferenczi, Grodek, and one other guy were internists to start with. They trained as general internists, family docs, and then they got analytic training. And unique things about the Hungarian Institute were that it was based in this sort of notion of mutual analysis of Ferenczi's. And in the training, the candidate's training analyst would also be his or her first supervisor. So there was a kind of sense of mutual discovery. It was, I think, quite non-authoritarian. And I think it's possible to see some of the basic tenets of a Ballant group and what Ballant came to both discover and create when he went to England. He left Hungary in 1939 after trying very hard to convince his parents to leave before the Nazis came in. They refused. He left with his then wife, Alice, and his parents took cyanide before they were captured. So he arrives in England, you know, shaken and I think probably grief-stricken. And within about 6 or 7 years, he became a member of the British Psychoanalytic and visited the Tavistock Clinic. His first wife had died, and he met Enid there. I forget her maiden name, but she was then running these mother-infant groups at the Tavistock, which were, kind of, you could see Ballant sort of watching her. Then she and the group, the sort of family study group at Tavistock, invited him to join them. And I think in one of her quotations, she says he kind of took us over. but he was fascinated with the model of looking at the relation, creating groups that had infants and mothers kind of in a group, learning from each other with the facilitation of Enid Ballant. I think it did not take long for him to begin to think this could be applied, or a version of this could be offered to general medicine docs, family docs in the country. It was post-World War II.
So you're really outlining the threads that he pulled together from various sources, from Ferenczi, from mutual discovery, from mutual analysis, from mother-child. And he, I guess his genius was to synthesize it into a new model for physicians.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that there's a very clarion call article that he wrote in the International Journal of Psychoanalysis about, psychoanalysis and general medicine, general practice, where he outlines these what he called three crises in the history of psychoanalysis. The first being, would it open itself to child analysis and child work, which it certainly did, and to the great benefit of children and psychoanalysis itself. Then he goes on to mark the sort of turning away of institutional psychoanalysis from group process. And despite the fact that Bion had run, brilliantly run, a hospital with a very small staff for the, I think, the Royal Air Force in England. And, but so he felt that was a loss for both the study of groups and psychoanalysis. And then here was this third crisis of general practice, and how is psychoanalysis going to contribute, you know, become a part of that and help it in its crisis. And at that point, most people estimate, most primary care family physicians you talk to will say that about half of their visits in any given week are emotional, situational, relational problems. But following World War II, it was even greater because a lot of the, you know, shell-shocked veterans returning to England after the war, there's nothing like an adequate mental health system. So most of them were falling in the laps of their family practitioners. So the National Health Service of England helped to kind of sponsor the early talent research cum. Anyway, the early groups were portrayed as mutual research into the process of the doctor-patient relationship.
Can you describe what a group like that would have been back then and what they've become nowadays?
I think back then, you know, Ballant was very sensitive to what he called the fact that psychoanalysis, in its efforts to kind of participate in general medicine, and Freud's initial ambition to have it be part of medicine, was that somehow formal ego-psychological, psychoanalytic theory, the two-person consulting room interpretive based on the unconscious, he described it as being like a foreign body in the corpus of medical practice. And he was sensitive to the fact that interpreting the unconscious was not serving the needs or the the kind of personal self-esteem of the physicians who attended the group. So he offered himself as a participant, and that he would be learning with them. But I think from the very beginning, he was very clear about what a Ballant group was not. And that's continued to this day, that it's not psychotherapy. It's not an in-depth exploration of what he called the private countertransference of the physician, which would be their history and their personal lives and stuff. But it was a group participation in the elucidation of dynamics that were observable and relatable to a group of like-minded or like-professioned physicians. So, from the very beginning, the group would last an hour and a half to two. It would, I think, initially met every week, maybe, or every other week.
And for just paint a picture, there'd be how many people there, and how would the discussions begin?
Usually about 10 physicians, men and women, and he would begin a group with who's got a case. And these would be off-the-cuff, kind of just curbside hallway presentations of a case that was either keeping the person up at night, the physician, or had in some way troubled them. And the case would be presented, and one of the things that he did and that we still do in running a Ballant group is sort of try to steer away from generalizations and steer the presentation of the case toward details. So there's often a request for more specific information. And the case is then sort of given to the group. Usually there was a period of time where the participants in the group could then ask for some details about the case. And the one in his international journal is a very complicated family case that is really very interesting. But currently in the Ballant groups that the International and the American Ballant Society train people in, there's a period where after the questions are asked by the group, the presenter is asked to sort of push the chair back, to sort of assume a position of kind of reverie and be sort of outside, kind of inaccessible to further questioning or interaction from the group. And then the group begins to kind of just sort of process the case and talk about what they felt listening to it and what they imagined the patient felt, what they imagined the doctor felt. And this can go on for 20 to 25 minutes, this sort of group reverie, and the presenter is sort of allowed to be right there, but kind of listening in and closing their eyes, and then they rejoin the group. And so it's kind of, you can hear elements of mutual analysis in that, and there's a great deal of safety in the fact that the it's really the professional person of the physician that's talking about his difficulty and about the case. And my friend Aaron Metzger, I asked him to sort of define to me what his think the essence of a group facilitator is. And he says it's primarily to protect the presenter from efforts to go too much into unconscious or personal territory and really keep the discussion going on the case itself. And the facilitator will also notice certain patterns that seem to happen in the group. And that's sort of that observation of kind of the group Rorschach, if you will, or the pattern that particular case kind of set up in the group discussion. That's something that Ballant did, and it feels as a facilitator that that's where probably some more kind of psychodynamic or group psychological skills are useful. And in this long-running Ballant group in Boston, the group members then take that on too.
Let me just get the picture to make sure I have it right. So these are physicians, 10 physicians, I guess, of various degrees of training. Of being in practice, and somebody is asked to present a case that troubles them. It could be their medical uncertainty about the case, or the case stirring them up, or something that unsettles them. And they come in and they just talk off the top of their head about their experience of the case, and they're asked details to flesh it out. Then they remove themselves from the group, and the group, again, no therapists, no psychiatrists, these are all medical people, and they sort of associate together about what they would do in such a situation, how they might feel, who they would be afraid to tell what about, and they would find a sense of safety together and share among themselves and thereby support the person who presented and let the person know, presumably, that they're not a terrible human being for having these thoughts, imaginings, and fears. And then the presenter would rejoin the group. Do I have that right? And what would happen then?
Mm-hmm. And what happens then is, the group and the presenter join in further exploration of the case.
Can you give us a sample case as disguised as you feel need be, just so that we can have a sense of how the process works?
Sure. This was a person whose case it was is now deceased, but he was a longstanding member of this group. And this comes from the group I was facilitating. And he is a very, highly revered, respected primary care doctor here. And He had been in the Ballant group for a long time, and then he said he wanted to present this case of his work with a woman whose husband had died. And so he presented the case. She basically was very grief. He was the doctor for both the husband and the wife, and so she's coming to see him after the husband had died, and she's grief-stricken, and he thinks and offers a referral to a psychiatrist. She comes back after seeing that person a time or two and says, "I really didn't feel comfortable talking to him. I'd really like to talk to you about, I forget his name, but her husband, you know him, and I know you." And And this doctor had always wanted to sort of try a little bit of formal of psychotherapy. So he was good friends with one of the senior analysts in the hospital. And so I approached him and said, would you supervise me kind of on a regular basis while I see this woman, you know, woman in her 60s, early 70s that I've known a long time. And he said, sure. So so they embarked on kind of a supervised 6-month course of its bereavement psychotherapy. And he was very happy with that and very, very gratified with it. And he said, but what happened next is what I really want to sort of talk about is that when she came, we actually came to our conclusion. We finished our sessions at 6 months. And then 2 or 3 months later, it was time for her sort of annual physical and checkup. And she came in for that. And she came into the clinical office and was kind of preparing to, you know, get into a gown and do the, and he said, you know, wait a minute, let's think about this. He said, you know, we've been through something together the last 6 months that feels very important to both of us, but it feels like it's changed our relationship. I'm not sure it feels right for us to just proceed with the physical exam. And she was very relieved. And she said, you know, I'm really glad to hear you say that. But what was interesting in the group and in his discussion was that he said, you know, I don't think I would have sort of sensitized to that shift if I hadn't been, you know, in this group for all these years. And it was just a very nice example of the wisdom that's kind of inherent in every human being if they're given a chance to cultivate it. And this was a person without a lot of formal education in psychotherapeutic boundaries or just things like that. I'm sure he'd heard of it, but it was a discovery in the group of that a relationship can only sort of hold so much. And the intimacy that they'd shared in the grief work really felt like it needed to be honored. So he referred her on to a colleague for her medical care from that point on.
It's a lovely story. And it shows the power of the group and the creativity and integrity of this man to appreciate that and to appreciate the touching, the metaphoric touching that they did in their therapy work, made physical touching something different than it would have been and referred elsewhere. That's quite a story. I know, Randy, that you have an interest in mindfulness, and you integrate that, is my understanding, in some way in your work with physicians and patients. Can you share that with the group?
Well, in the Balint group, I was, at the time I was leading this Balint group, I was also getting some training in leading mindfulness-based stress reduction groups. There's a very active center for mindfulness at the UMass Worcester Medical Center. Jon Kabat-Zinn created a whole center, which is really kind of the research sort of model for mindfulness and it's the practice of meditation and helping with chronic pain. And so anyway, I have a thing which to me feels like I'm a grandson of Michael Balint in that I don't feel that comfortable referring people to interactive experiential areas if I don't have some experience of what they're like. So I was noticing that a lot of the patients in the primary care setting that I was the director of psychiatry division of were coming back feeling, I guess, much more able to deal with their chronic illness. They were much more kind of workable with their physicians. So anyway, John offered me a chance to start training when the clinic was very young. And so I asked the group if when we did the part of the group after the presentation had occurred, the case presentation, and the questions had been asked, and the presenter is about to pull their chair back, I just asked if they wanted to sit for 2 minutes, and I would ring a chime and just have a little bit of meditative space there to allow their associations, in a sense, to kind of become more visible to them. So we began doing that. And they really, I mean, that's that's not the whole story about mindfulness in my analytic practice, but it's how we integrated it into the Balint group. And they still do it. They became quickly kind of a, it just sort of felt like it gave them space to tune into their associative processes to kind of quiet the room down. And I visited the group occasionally over the last number of years that Aaron Metzger's been running it. And they still do the chime and so it became part of their operating. I do think that, again, mindfulness is whether it's going to be good for a patient or not is a, is an experiential question, or it's a question that can only be answered in some kind of experience-based way. So my last hospital job was in a clinic that was sort of complementary alternative medicine, and I ran these mindfulness groups, 3 or 4 a year. It's an 8-week group. I took to characterizing myself as a Sherpa when I would lead them, and then I'd get referrals from the other practitioners. You know, would a mindfulness group be good for this person? And I realized that we were kind of talking around it, and it was sort of hit or miss whether it would really be a good idea or not. So I kind of initiated this thing. I presented to the staff of the clinic as sort of a mindfulness biopsy, which is I would ask the patient who was consulting with me if they minded if we did a brief meditation together. And so we would set up in our chairs. I would get out my chimes and lead basically a 3-minute brief meditation. But it was very informative. It became the referrals were much more.
A diagnostic tool, as it were, right?
Yeah. And, you know, people who were more dependent than they had indicated on dissociative defenses or mechanisms of trauma, they would often say that was a terrible 3 minutes. I don't want to get that close to my breath or a somatic sensation.
Speaking about experiential treatments, one of the questions that this podcast series is focused on is, how does being a psychoanalyst give one particular skills in working in the various venues that we're learning about psychoanalysts working in? And I think you've answered it without my asking it directly in describing the associative process and the protection of the patient and the notion of a safe space. But let me not speak for you. Can you share your own thoughts about what it is about being analytically trained that you find useful in this work?
For me, the way in which getting ready for this podcast, I kind of reread some old presentations I'd made and things I'd read about Balint. And I think, you know, his model of primary love or the basic fault has become much more kind of how we view psychoanalysis today than it was, say, in the old days of reflecting mirror and the interpretive zeroing in on the unconscious. So I think that being, you know, exquisitely attuned to the shame potential of too deep an interpretation in a Balint group, I think that takes an analytically trained person, I think, to be able to see that if it happened or understand why it happened if it does. It's not really something he or she presents to the group is this is why I'm doing that, but it's definitely a use of his or her analytic self and training.
Yes, well said. Well, I want to thank you because I mean I've been reading up on Balint also in preparation to our talking, but the thread that I hear in what you're teaching us is the 50% of the patients that go to general practitioners today who are suffering from some sort of either purely emotional or emotional somatic suffering, when listened to and engaged with in a process like you're describing by Balint physicians, draw a direct line back to Ferenczi in the early part of the 20th century and his discoveries and his connection to Balint and the Hungarian Institute and mutual discovery. And if any of us are history buffs and the history of our field and of medicine in general, to really appreciate that lineage, I find really fascinating. And it puts us in debt to our forefathers. We're always growing and building on it, but it's so nice to see where this began.
It is. And I think there is a through line there. I think the Hungarian model was kind of an ideal antecedent for the way a ballant group sort of unfolds. And it's avoided this kind of foreign body in the corpus of medicine sort of problem. I think there's a lot of good consultation liaison psychiatrists who were analytically trained, at Don Lipset and Ted Nadelson and others, who were able to demonstrate through like one-way mirrors or interviews of patients, different character types, the usefulness of an analytic understanding of, say, a narcissistic or a paranoid person. And there was a whole series of videotapes that were done in Boston showing certain basic analytic notions about how to deal with a narcissistic person could be translated.
Now you've added the mindfulness piece to it, which is our contribution. Randy, I really want to thank you for taking the time and sharing with us your clinical wisdom and historical knowledge. I've learned a lot. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.